Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show this week. And on behalf of the entire Kelly Alexander Show team, we hope this new year is treating you well and that you march through the next 12 months with much success, health, and happiness. Now, this week on the program, we take a look back at the busy year that was. We had so many wonderful guests who had a lot to say, not to mention some amazing experts who passed along their knowledge in their chosen field. We also enjoyed some fun topics and segments, so we've decided to revisit them one more time. Enjoy the show, and thank you so much for your continued support.
Capture your need for sound.
The big news that's come out this month is the latest version of the iPhone. A lot of Apple fans were expecting to hear about an iPhone 5, but Apple threw a bit of a curveball and came out with the iPhone 4S. To tell us all about this new smartphone is syndicated technology columnist Mark Saltzman, who was at the actual unveiling in California. Mark, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me.
Mark, I guess right off the top, I have to ask you if you were surprised that no iPhone 5 came out. Did you expect to see it?
I did. You know, I mean, some years they have major improvements to their smartphones and other years are more marginal. And this was, you know, and at least initially, it doesn't seem like there's a huge jump over the existing iPhone. But the iPhone 4S does have more features under the hood. It looks identical to last year's model. But, you know, along with a better camera and faster processor and better wireless connectivity, the feature I think that got everybody excited, and this wasn't unveiled until the end of the event, by the way, the feature that everybody was talking about is called Siri, S-I-R-I. And this is best described as like a personal assistant. You talk to your iPhone like you would a friend, and the information that you're looking for is immediately displayed or said by this female voice. So it's pretty cool. You could say, do I need a rain jacket today? And it'll say, no, you won't need a rain jacket today, and it'll show you the weather. Or you can say, you know, I feel like Italian food, what's around me? And it'll show you restaurants displayed by rating that fits your criteria. So everything you say is understood, not just transcribed into text, which also is a part of it. For example, you can talk your emails or text messages out, and it'll show up as text in the phone, or it'll read your text messages to you. So it's got all these really cool bells and whistles. So I think that is going to be the killer app for the iPhone 4S.
And with regards to this, I guess, voice-powered assistant, how accurate do you think it's going to be, Mark? Is it going to hold up in the real world?
Well, I did test it after the event. I did get some hands-on time with the iPhone 4S, and surprisingly, it was quite accurate, almost 100%. I would say, what's the weather in Toronto? And it would say, here's the weather in Toronto, Mark, and it would show you the weather. So it understood everything I said. There was one instance where I wanted to add an entry to my calendar, and it got one word wrong or something. So, I mean, really, it's pretty clever. And that was in a noisy room as well. So I think that, you know, Apple has really innovated when it comes to the interface. We moved away from sort of a mouse and keyboard interface to a touch-based one, you know, largely due to Apple with the iPhone and the iPod Touch and the iPad. And now we're moving, I believe, into the next phase, which is voice interaction. And there's still a ways to go, but, you know, it was science fiction when, you know, in Star Trek, when Captain Kirk was talking to the computer and getting an answer from the artificial intelligence. But I think we're inching towards that, and the iPhone 4S is definitely the first step towards that.
Regarding the camera part of it, I know because I was reading a few articles, obviously, all afternoon long about, you know, the 4S and the thing that came up apart from this voice-powered assistant was the camera. So what's your take on it?
Yeah, so definitely a better camera. And we are using our smartphone as a camera. And now there are fewer trade-offs for doing so. So instead of a 5-megapixel camera with last year's model, it's now an 8-megapixel camera. So you can print off, you know, an 8x10 glossy photo, and it'll look gorgeous. It also has better optics technology overall for better low light performance and richer colors. Plus, it lets you now shoot HD video in up to 1080p quality, which is the highest, you know, quality video recording capability there is. So last year it was 720p, now it's 1080p. Again, it's more evolutionary than revolutionary. You know, these enhancements that have been added aren't over the top. They are what's to be expected, a faster processor, better camera, you know, better wireless connectivity. But I think that this series feature is really the one that's going to get everybody buzzing.
And with regards, I have to ask you as well, the speed thing, is that really going to make a big difference to regular users, or is it really for gamers?
Well, you know, for anyone who downloads through cellular connectivity, so I'm not talking about Wi-Fi when you're in a wireless network, but if you're, say, on a park bench or on a moving train and you want to access the web faster or download content faster, you're now going to get up to twice the speed. So they really have improved that. Some, you know, Apple stopped short of calling it 4G, which is, you know, a buzzword that's really a loose one because there's the criteria for 4G performance is all over the map. But without question, in the U.S., especially where I am right now, that they have a lot of, you know, reception issues and dead pockets and things like that. So reception is a sticky point for any smartphone maker. In Canada, we're a bit privileged. You know, we've got very reliable, high-speed access everywhere. But even still, with the iPhone 4S, you will get even greater speeds because of this dual antenna approach that Apple says they're the first to employ.
Joining us on the show this week is syndicated technology columnist Mark Saltzman from Toronto. Make sure you check him out. The best place to do that on Facebook, facebook.com/Mark Saltzman. Now, Mark, I have to ask you, we talked briefly about it, the fact that the 4S looks, you know, identical to the 4. Were you disappointed that the hardware was the same? Did they need to change anything on it?
Yeah, if I were Apple, I think that, you know, definitely faster processor, better camera, that's all to be expected. But if I were Apple, I would have introduced a larger screen. I think that we're starting to use our smartphones more like a computer, not just for something to talk on or to type on. So I would have preferred a 4 or 4.5 inch touchscreen display for playing games and watching video and the like. So I was a bit disappointed that it was the exact same hardware, the exact same design with the 3.5 inch screen. But I guess I understand it. You know, Apple right now has the number one selling smartphone in the world. So, you know, why rock the boat? So I guess they're playing it safe and they're saying, well, everybody likes our design, so why don't we just change the guts of the machine and innovate there? And, you know, for the iPhone 5, we'll change the game again. So, you know, as the name suggests, it's the iPhone 4S. It's S stands for speed. It's really not meant to be a huge radical redesign. But I think the reason why many people were disappointed is because Apple never tells you what they're going to unveil, and you couple that with the fact that Apple has a huge and loyal following. So as a result, it causes all these rumors to run rampant online. You know, everybody's predicting what the next Apple product's going to look like and behave like. So I think as a result, you're always going to be disappointed because it's never going to live up to your imagination. So just to keep it in check, it is better than last year's version in a number of ways. It's the same price as when the iPhone 4 debuted. And again, this feature called Siri is really something that you need to experience to get. It's really impressive.
The models, I'm assuming, the same as all the other ones, the 16 and 32 and so on?
Yes, that's correct. So the memory, the configuration is the same. But keep in mind that the iPhone 4S is also going to be the first smartphone to ship with the new iCloud and the new iOS software. Both of those are debuting on the 14th of October next week. And these are, you know, updates to the iOS 5 is their new operating system, which has 200 or so more features. And then iCloud is the ability to access content even if it's not stored on your device. So even though you may be limited in local storage, you're going to be able to access content in the cloud or on the internet as if it was stored locally on your smartphone. So it becomes less of an issue if you, say, only have a 16 gig device and you want to access things that you typically only were able to on a 32 gig device.
And just a quick question, because I was reading something online about that iCloud, and I wanted to ask you, for people who are sort of sitting at home going, I don't understand. So let's say they get the 4S, they have this access to iCloud. Does that mean then that all their Apple devices will have access to iCloud as well?
That's right. So iCloud is a way of uploading and sharing content between all of your devices in the cloud. And the cloud is just a slang term for the internet. And it's essentially the ability to download, let's say you download music on your computer, on your iTunes, on your computer, and it, all those songs magically appear on your iPhone and iPad and iPod Touch at the same time. So that's an example of iCloud applications. Or you take a picture on your new iPhone 4S or another iPhone, and that photo is automatically synchronized with your iPad or your home computer. So it's a way of sharing your music, your apps, your audiobooks, your photos, and other content between all of your devices instead of having to tether one to the other and copy it. You know, like right now, if I take pictures on my iPhone, unless I email them, I have to connect it to my computer with a white cable and manually drag and drop the photos over to my computer, unplug it, and then they're on my computer. Whereas with the iCloud, whatever photos I take on my iPhone are automatically appearing on my computer.
I think a lot of people are going to love that ability.
Yeah, you know, cloud computing, we're all moving towards it, and Apple certainly isn't the first or only company that's embracing this technology. But it is meant to, you know, to make things easier, more seamless, and save us some time. You know, again, you take pictures with your camera, you got to, you know, eject the memory card and plug it into your computer and drag it. It's a pain. So the idea behind the cloud is that we're always connected to the internet in some way, shape, or form, whether it's over cellular connectivity or Wi-Fi, maybe at a coffee shop or in your home or at work. So all your content should be accessible wherever you are at any time on any device.
That's amazing. And I have to ask you this, Mark, because I think there's a lot of people sitting at home now, again, because I think, like you mentioned off the top, a lot of people were expecting, you know, the 5 and a big change or whatever. So with regards to the 4S, should all of us, you know, 3GS and iPhone 4 users be looking to upgrade, or should we be waiting?
Well, if there's going to be a penalty for canceling your contract, I would say stick with what you got. You know, the iPhone 4, I think, is a terrific phone as it is. Even with the new one that's better and, you know, cooler, I still think the iPhone 4 is a great phone. Plus, the iPhone 4 and 3GS, they're both eligible to download the new software, iOS 5, on October 14th and access the cloud, iCloud. Also, you know, launching that day. So it's really, you know, I think the one thing you'll miss is Siri. And I asked Apple today why, if it sounds like it's software-based, you press and hold the home button and then talk to your smartphone. If it's software-based, why can't people who own an older iPhone download that? And they said that it does need that faster processor, that new dual-core A5 chip that's in the new iPhone 4S. It's the same technology that's powering the iPad, too, tablet. They said you need that kind of horsepower for this to work. So I think Siri is the killer app. If you're going to want to upgrade, it's because you have a friend that shows you how cool it is to, you know, ask to tell your phone, make an appointment at 12 o'clock for lunch with Kelly, and it'll automatically populate your calendar for you with that. You know, just by saying it into your phone. We've never seen that before.
No, and I think that's amazing because I hate typing in my appointments.
It's those little menial tasks that make it so much easier. Like today I pressed the button and I said, take me to the Golden Gate Bridge, and right away it pulled up the Google Maps and showed me the you know, how to get to you know, the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge from where I was in Cupertino outside of San Jose. So it was like seamless, instead of having to open up the app manually, typing in Golden Gate Bridge. Like it's just the voice technology is really very cool.
That's amazing. And just before I let you go, Mark, again, I know, and you and I have talked about this before, how Apple again keeps, you know, the cards close to their chest, but do you think in the coming months we will see some sort of difference with an iPad, like an iPad 3?
Yeah, so again, I was hoping they would hint at something today, given the fact there's a lot more competition in the tablet space. But we will not likely hear anything about iPad 3 until early 2012. Apple has the commanding market share in the tablet space. You know, more than 3 out of 4 tablets sold are iPads, let's face it. So I guess they don't feel like they need to hint or reveal what they're working on next. They're keeping their competition in the dark as well. And, you know, I'm super excited. I can honestly say, and I'm a PC guy, I'm a Windows guy, by the way. I might sound like an Apple fanboy, but really I'm a Windows guy. I can honestly say though, that the iPad is my favorite gadget ever that never leaves my side.
Wow.
So I'm personally and professionally excited about what's coming down the road for iPad 3. But I think we're going to have to wait a few more months for that.
Okay, excellent. Mark, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Again, that's Mark Saltzman, a syndicated technology columnist from Toronto. Make sure you check him out on Facebook, facebook.com/Mark Saltzman.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Going through a breakup is never fun. In fact, in certain instances, it can be downright heartbreaking, and you may feel like you're never going to get through it. To help you have the tools available on how to cope with this situation, especially if you share children, is relationship coach and relationship columnist for the West End Times newspaper, Frank B. Kermit. Frank, thanks again for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. Great to be here.
Frank, what's the first thing that you should do with yourself, you know, after you break up with someone, or if you get broken up with, and, you know, if you're sort of a family unit?
Okay, well, if there are children involved, the first thing you'd better make sure is that this is an actual final breakup. This isn't just a temporary leave of absence where you both need to get your thoughts collected. The reason you want to make sure that this is an actual end of the relationship is because when you do finally communicate this to your children, and you must communicate this together, you may now have an ex, but you are still partners when it comes to raising your children. If you tell your children that, yes, we are separating, and then later on you guys work it out and go back to trying to have a family unit, that does not create an environment that is stable for children. And it could have negative impact on them where they realize that nothing is stable and that getting together, breaking up is part of a normal course of a relationship. Now, in every relationship, you are going to fight. You are going to have disagreements. You may very well need to leave each other's space temporarily. But to get together, break up is not an emotionally healthy relationship. But if that's what your children are seeing, that's what they're going to pick up. They're going to say, oh, this is the norm. And if your child grows up and ends up in an emotionally healthy relationship that doesn't have these constant breakups back and forth, they're going to assume that they have a bad relationship, and they'll walk away from emotionally healthy relationships. It's called attachment theory. It's very important that you're sure that this end is the final end before you talk to your children.
And if you do have, you know, children together, Frank, I'm assuming that, I'm not sure how to phrase this, but I'm assuming that in a way their needs surpass your own because, you know, they're little and they need lots of support, you know, going through the changes ahead. And even if they're not so little, even if they're, you know, 14, it's still, I think, above their emotional understanding point.
It's very important when you talk to your kids that, you know, you talk to your kids as a couple and you say that although we're not going to be together anymore and we're not getting along, we still love you. And you have to reinforce this for your partner. So even though you may be angry at your partner, you still have to remind the kids that your partner is still a good parent. And if you're not supporting one another in this, it's going to damage your children on an emotional level. And emotionally damaged children end up turning on the parents by trying to manipulate the situation to their advantage, turning the parents against each other. It's very important that as parents, you must remain on the same page even if you're not going to be life partners anymore.
And how do you handle, you know, contentious situation around the kids? Because I'm assuming that the less they see you fight, the better. So if you are, you know, things are going badly and it's looking like it's the end, is it very important that you have these discussions when the kids are at school or asleep and they're not going to hear you?
Well, to assume that the kids are asleep and in another room and not hearing you, this is what most people think, and it doesn't work. We've all been kids who have pretended to sleep so we could see what exactly is going on and try to listen in. If you have to have these fights, if you have to have these discussions, yes, you try to have them out of your children's ear range. Sometimes that's not possible. We're all human, and we all have different temperaments. We all reach a point sometimes where we just have to let it out now. And that's unfortunate if we can't control our tempers when we're around children. So as much as possible, you want to limit this because you have to remember, even in couples that stay together long term, whenever they fight, and assuming they do it in front of the children do not have the concept of what happens after they go to bed. So here's an example. A couple who was very much in love, and they were together for many, many years, they would often have fights. Now, the fights wouldn't be really bad, but they would be, you know, arguments and everything for, well, what's for dinner tonight? Well, I don't know. I didn't make anything. Well, why didn't you make something? The child picks up, wow, the two of you are always fighting. What the child doesn't see is that, okay, after the initial blowout or whatnot, the couple actually makes up, they get intimate, they reconnect after a lousy day of work. But the child doesn't see that part, so all the child sees is, wow, these two people are always at each other's throats. So you have to remember that if you are the type of couple that has outbursts in front of the children need to see the intimacy, the children need to see the caring and the affection you have for one another. Children will not just assume that it's all what's happening behind my back. They don't have that capacity, especially if they're younger.
How do you make sure that the children do not blame themselves for your breakup? Because it just feels like it's going to come crashing down on their heads.
It's important to understand that children view themselves as the center of their universe. So a child may have this interpretation. My parents are splitting up because they got really, really mad. Well, why did they get mad? Well, the last time they got really mad, it's because I didn't clean up my room. So they must have got mad. They must have fought about that. So they're breaking up because of me. Because the child does not have the concept that maybe the parents have been unhappy for a long time. And there's a lot of unresolved issues there that are beyond the scope of the child's understanding. So it's not about trying to avoid it. It's understanding that's what's going to happen. Those kids are going to blame themselves because that's how children think.
In regards to the fact that when they're younger, you know, they're sort of very focused on themselves, does that continue into to teenagehood too? Like, would they be blaming themselves for your breakup at, like, you know, 15, 16, 17?
Some children will, because, again, they may not have the capacity to understand that mom and dad or dad and dad and mom have their own problems. At the teenage level, they're going through so many other things in their development, trying to form their own identity, trying to find their place in the world. Maybe they've got their own issues that they're dealing with that they aren't sharing with anybody because they have nobody to be a confidant with. And this is just one more thing in their life that's not working out. So will the child, or in this case, will the teenager blame themselves? They can. If they feel, because again, you have adults who feel that they are at fault for everybody else's misery. This is a learned behavior. So you might have a teenager who has that. A teenager who may not have that is still going to look at this as an example of why nothing works out in life and what's the point. And that's a very, very dangerous attitude for a teenager to have, especially when at that point in their lives, they are tempted by people who would do them wrong, who would do them harm, who try to get them involved in things that they shouldn't be getting involved in.
Frank, I don't even know if you can answer this, but I just want to put this out there. And I suppose that it depends on an individual basis, I guess. But if you could comment on it anyway, is there an age where a child would handle this better? Like, is it better that they're beneath 10 or is it better that they're above 10?
You know, I don't know the research on this to properly give an answer. There are children who, because their parents split up when they were so young that they don't remember it, they don't know what it is they're missing. They weren't around or they don't remember the fights and the things that led up to the breakup. So they're growing up already in single-parent households. And as long as they're receiving love and they're receiving nurturing, they can turn out okay. It's the child who maybe is directly exposed to the pattern of the breakup who remembers what happened or at least has their interpretation of what happened that might have to carry this. And there are adults who do not fare very well when their parents split up. So I don't think it's so much an issue of what age the child is. I think it's more of an issue of has that person, regardless of their age, been taught to deal with disappointments in life.
Okay, and probably as well how the situation in and of itself was handled with them.
Exactly. If the situation was handled with sensitivity and maturity on behalf of both parents, you're going to have a kid who's got a really good shot at coming out of this not too scathed, and that's a good thing.
Joining us on the show is relationship coach and columnist for the West End Times, Frank B. Kermit. Check him out at his website, www.franktalks.com. Frank, how do you tell the children that you and your partner are no longer together? Is this like a sit-down thing with the two of you?
Usually it is. You sit down with your now ex-partner, and you have to really focus on how, although the nature of your relationship with your partner has changed, your relationship with your child has not changed, that you both still love your child, that you both will still be there, and you have to prepare for an outburst. The child may freak out. The child might start calling you names and start exhibiting so much anger because you've just changed such an important component in their life. You also have to be ready for the questions. What's going to happen to me? Where am I going to live? Who's going to take care of me? And remember, let's say the child has some sort of after-school activities. Within the scope of a child's world, those things are uber important. And if you don't have an answer to say, well, we've already arranged a schedule so you can continue to do the things that are important to you, that's going to shake a child up even more. It's not just the devastation that the child's parents are breaking up. It's also, how is my life as a child going to change in this? And that can also lead to lots of feelings of resentment. You have to expect that your kid is going to freak out, and you have to encourage it. You have to say, no, get it out now. Ask all of your questions out. If you're angry, that's okay. And whatever the kid says, no matter how nasty, no matter how hurtful, you have to be accepting of it. You have to show compassion. Because as devastating as it is for you as an adult in the situation, it's even more devastating for them as a child.
And I'm assuming, Frank, that especially, you know, having to sit down and tell your kid, mom and dad, or dad and dad, mom and mom, not going to be together anymore. Obviously, that's such a heartbreaking thing to go through, especially if you really do love your child as much as I think most parents do. The two parents really need to try to simmer down before they have that conversation, right? Because I think they need to work really hard at getting through their emotions so that it's the best possible conversation that they can have with their child, so that the feelings between both parents are sort of just negligible at this point.
Exactly. You have to remember that it's not a time to take jabs at one another. It's not a time to put the blame as to why you can't be with your partner anymore. There's only one goal, and the goal is to reassure the child that all of the child's needs are going to continue to be met. That it's going to be a different setup, but the child's needs will always be met, and no matter what happens, the two partners and now ex-partners are still going to work together when it comes to raising the child.
And Frank, if possible, I guess it's important that both parents sit down in advance and hammer down a schedule as best they can so that the kid doesn't really feel upheaval?
Exactly. The more you plan ahead for exactly what is going to take place in the care of the child, the better it is for the child. Because at that point, when two parents sit down and say, we're not going to be together anymore, and they're trying to explain this to a child, any uncertainty, in addition to the fact that the child now realizes, oh, so this whole family unit thing isn't forever. Any uncertainty on top of that in terms of, well, who's going to spend Sundays with the child, that's just even more devastating to the child. The child needs some sense of schedule, some sense of belonging, some sense that I'm going to be taken care of no matter what. And you do, when you put this schedule down in writing, there has to be some flexibility because your child might turn around and say, well, wait a minute, if I'm going to spend weeknights with one parent and weekends with the other parent, but I watch Monday night show TV show with my other parent, what's going to happen then? So you're going to have to be flexible, especially at the very beginning. That is not a time to use children as a means of getting revenge on your partner, no matter what happened in that relationship.
And please tell me, Frank, that, you know, the adults are going to be smart enough, you know, not to say negative things about the other parent, I guess, even, you know, whether it's in front of the other parent or not, just in front of that child, because that has to be so damaging for the kid to hear that parent B wants to dismantle parent A or whatever the case may be.
Okay, it's more than just dismantling for the child. This is how a child interprets it. When parent A hates parent B, the child says, but I'm half parent B. So parent A must hate me just as much as parent B.
That's such a good way to put it, Frank, because I think no one thinks of it that way.
Exactly, because as adults, we can separate our feelings. We know that just because we may dislike somebody's sibling, that doesn't mean we hate the person. But as a child, they don't have that emotional maturity. They don't have that capacity. So if you hate one of my parents, you must hate that part in me because I'm half of that parent. And don't think that children who are adopted are immune to this because they're still being brought up in that family unit. They still take on the character traits and the behavior traits of a parent. When you hate somebody's parent, even if it's your ex-partner, the person, the child, is going to feel you hate a good chunk of them. And that's horrible.
And how do you ensure that the children don't take sides or feel forced to take sides, Frank?
Well, there are certain things we can do. First of all, don't introduce a new partner anytime soon, because that puts the child in a position where they may feel guilty for taking sides. So let's say partner A goes out and meets a new person to start dating. Well, the child may even like the new partner of partner A, but they're going to be in a position where they say, oh, but I feel guilty because I feel like I'm betraying partner B, so I have to hate partner A's new partner. You don't put children in that situation. Even if you have someone new in your life, you don't introduce them to your kids because that just adds a new element to this. Initially, most kids are hoping that mom and dad or mom and dad are hoping that their parents are going to work it out. And any new person that you introduce during that very, very sensitive time could become the target of hatred, saying, my parents never worked out because you came into the picture. Even if the reality is, that first relationship was dead, regardless of who new comes in.
And Frank, is there ever a good reason, because we've heard this, you know, for eons and eons, that certain families will stay together, you know, because until the kids are raised or the kids are old enough, is there ever a good reason for two parents to stay together on behalf of the kids for whether it's 3 months or a year or 10 years?
Of course. Of course. Listen, there is no set rule for this. There are some families that when they're together, because they have a common goal of we're going to stick it out, we're going to stay together, we're not going to expose our kids to any sort of hurt, or we're not exposing our kids to any of our own relationship dysfunctions, at least get to the point where the kid is finished school, gotten their degree, started a career. Of course there's an argument for that, because in some cases a couple splitting up might mean that both people in the couple will have less time to spend with their kids. And let's look at all of the kids right now who are being neglected. If their parents aren't spending time with them and looking after them, someone who may want to do them wrong is going to be paying them the wrong kind of attention. So there's always an argument that, hey, you got kids, you better try to work it out. And if you're not going to work it out, stick it out for as long as you can. Now, on the flip side, if the dysfunction in the relationship is something that when the children are exposed to is going to damage them further, that's when you need to leave now. So a good example of this, if you're in a relationship that is dealing with domestic violence and children being exposed to that violence and being put at risk because of that violence, well, no, there is no staying together. You got to move on. But if it's a matter of the two of you have irreconcilable differences, you're still friends, you like each other as people, but it's just not working out. Sometimes staying together long enough for the benefit of the kids might be a good option. There are no absolute answers in this unless you're dealing with an absolute situation like domestic violence.
What's your opinion, Frank, on how the parents can handle their interaction with each other in the future, you know, around the kids? I'm assuming the more amicable, the better. And I guess working through that hurt, I don't want to say as quickly as possible because I think everyone has to feel their feelings, but at least getting through it enough that you can be with that other person and be parents together.
I think a key element is compassion. That's really what it comes down to it. To tolerate another person, to, you know, grind your teeth, to bite your tongue, all of that is fine, but eventually we all have a limit as to what we can take before it starts to really damage ourselves in terms of our esteem and in terms of our ability to enjoy life. However, if you can look at your partner and have compassion with the understanding that, you know, my partner is just as miserable as I am in this situation, maybe even more so, we're going to end up alone after this. So let's try to have compassion for the struggling and the rage that we both feel right now. I've often found that if there was one element that was missing to keep a couple from always biting each other's heads off, it's compassion. I'm not even looking at forgiveness. Because forgiveness is something you really do for yourself, so you can move on. but to offer compassion for someone, to try and understand their pain and trying to say, well, I'm not happy about the situation, but I will show you compassion for the pain that you're in. Sometimes that can turn around the reason that the couple would be breaking up to begin with.
Okay, that's excellent. Now, Frank, obviously this is such a big topic to go over, you know, dealing with a breakup, the aftermath and how you move forward. And, you know, we've based this, you know, specific talk on dealing with family and if you have children and how you move forward. But I want to have you back on the show because I know that you and I are going to talk about what it's like for a single person or without kids to sort of move forward after a breakup. Can you just give us some thoughts on what we will hear when you and I talk again about this this subject?
Absolutely. When you're dealing with a breakup where you do not have children with your partner, the dynamic is very different. Because at that point, you very well may never see that person again. And that's okay. When you do have children, because your children's needs end up becoming more important than your own specific needs, especially in that moment, your behaviors are going to change. But when you don't have kids, you end up having more options in terms of how you're going to deal with your ex-partner, and even if you choose not to deal with them at all. And that's what we're going to be looking at when we talk about childless couples who are going through a breakup.
Fantastic, Frank. Thank you so much again for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Kelly. It's always a pleasure.
Again, that's Frank B. Kermit, a relationship coach and columnist for the West End Times newspaper. Again, for more information, www.franktalks.com.
Hours go shorter as the days go by. We never get to stop and open our eyes. 1 minute you're waiting for the sky to fall, and next you're dazzled by the beauty of it all. Lovers in a dangerous time. These fragile bodies of touch and taste, this fragrant skin, this hair like lace, spirits open to a thrust of grace. Never a breath you can afford to waste.
Lovers in a dangerous time. Lovers in a dangerous time. Lovers in a dangerous time. We
welcome back to the show our almost mother of the year, Casey Savage, who writes for her blog of the same name and who also appears regularly on the Home Shopping Network. Casey, thanks for joining us on the show this week.
It's my pleasure. I always look forward to doing this.
Excellent. Now, Casey, I want you to set the scene for this month's topic, grooming your boys to be grooms.
It already sounds like basically a bad mother of the year award, but see, here's the thing. As everyone knows, or maybe they don't already know, but they will soon know, I have three boys, so I feel this huge responsibility as the only female in my household to make sure that they are top-notch quality dating and husband material for the future, and I put a lot of pressure on myself, but it's important. I mean, come on. We don't need any more deadbeat husbands out there. Am I right, ladies? Am I right? We're the ladies. I don't hear any ladies.
I'm the lady. There's a bunch of us behind me, so it's good.
Can you be sure to add some cheering ladies on that?
I will for sure. Now, okay, Casey, what's your philosophy then on, you know, kids doing chores?
I think, well, when I was a kid, my mom was still is, an absolute neat freak. And I always heard her harping voice, clean your room. Your room's a dump. My room could be the Taj Mahal and it was still a dump. So I just always had this nagging about cleaning my room. But now that I have my own family, I think to myself, wow, I'm really glad she instilled all those hard work ethic type values when it came to pitching it around the house, because I can see how hard it is to manage a house on your own when you've got kids running amok and a husband running around, and you're thinking to yourself, well, like, this is overwhelming. You could spend literally your whole day, every day for the rest of your life cleaning and never be done, or at least that's how it feels around my house. So if I've got kids that are able-bodied, working arms, working legs, working minds, then why not get them to pitch in around here? And they should, because my philosophy is this family is a team, and we have to work as a team to keep things clean.
Are you the coach?
Yes, I am. Can you tell? Do I have that coach voice? I sounded like I was giving a pep talk there.
You did.
All right, kids, huddle up. Listen to me. Now you, number one, you're doing toilets. Number two, you're vacuuming. Number three, you're wiping up the pee that landed on the floor from your earlier mishap in the washroom. Did I mention I have three boys? Anyone who has boys will instantly know what my powder room must smell like.
Nice. Now, I have to ask you, Coach, should the children, you know, be paid to do these said chores?
No. I honestly don't understand why you should pay your kids to do things they're supposed to do anyway. Like, why should I do all the cooking and cleaning around here? And I don't. Luckily, I've got a husband who, like, does every bit as much as whatever I do around the house and more. So we're already a good team in that sense. And then with the kids pitching in, Why should I pay them? No one's paying me to get the house clean. And when they say to me, why should I do it? Why do I have to do it? And I say, because I have to do it too. And the sooner we get things done together, the more time I have and they have to go do things we really want to do, which isn't cleaning a bathroom. But no, I pay my kids to do things above and beyond the call of duty. So if I'm looking out at the yard, and there's a ton of work to be done out there, and, you know, they've done their part, but I'm thinking, wow, I could really use some extra help, you know, doing this, that, the other. Then I will offer them something measly like a quarter. They don't know what the going rate is for work. They're still too young. So I offer them no more than a loonie, and that's for, like, serious hard labor. You've put in a good hour's work, I will pay them a loonie. Please, nobody contact my children and tell them about minimum wage.
Nice. Now, what, you know, types of chores do your kids do? And if you could please, you know, again, sort of reiterate their ages so that we have an idea of what they handle.
Okay, yeah, good point. Because right now people are probably picturing lazy layabout teenagers. No, I've got a four-year-old. It's so bad when I say it. A four-year-old, a five, almost six-year-old, and a newly eight-year-old son. And you know what? They are totally capable. And I love this parenting adage I read about once. It said, never do for your kids what they can do for themselves. So if my son, who's eight, can press buttons to run a washing machine, what's stopping him from doing laundry? Nothing. Just laziness or lack of knowledge. So I've shown him how to use that. So when he's got laundry piling up, I can say, hey, you know what, Wyatt? Today would be a great day for you to get some of your laundry done. And then once you get that chore over and done with, you can move on to whatever you want to do today and have fun. But we always have a get your jobs done first, have fun later policy. And I think that'll serve them well in life.
That is awesome. I just think that's great. And so Wyatt, 8, he's doing laundry. What else does he do? And then, you know, what are Noah and Spencer doing?
Well, they're all good at their own thing. So they all do a bit of everything, but some are, and I won't name names, Noah, better than others at doing certain projects. Noah is also known on my blog as Needy. He's the middle child, and he's a real people pleaser. So you can just lay as much onto him as he can handle, and he will still do it with a smile because he's eager to please. So Noah excels at folding laundry. He's very meticulous with matching up socks. He does a great job. He went to a really nice little Montessori where they had these pioneer skills where he'd have to wash the linens on a little scrub board. So luckily we have technology in our household. He doesn't have to use a scrub board for anything. But he's got that good work ethic. So that's great. Where Wyatt, he likes to do things. We have a push mower, so he likes to cut the grass. He'll do that sort of thing. He likes the more manual labor type things. And then Spencer, you just give him something simple and straightforward because he is only 4. He loves pushing buttons, so he can help with the laundry as well. But he's great at bending down low and holding the dustpan. That seems to be his forte because his accuracy on crumb collection with the broom is not exactly what it should be.
So I gotcha.
He's the dustpan man.
Okay, nice. All right. Joining us on the show, Casey Savage, Almost Mother of the Year. Make sure you check her out at almostmotheroftheyear.blogspot.com. Casey, are your kids, you know, trained seals, or do they protest, you know, at the chores that they have to do?
Oh, of course they protest. They you know, at least 4 times a day, and if it's something simple as they're right now, they're programmed mentally because they've been doing it so long, they clear their plates and put them in the dishwasher after they're done. So that's done. But I'll still have to remind them, okay, which one of you guys is going to wipe the table? Which one's sweeping? Which one's holding the dustpan, or which one's helping me tidy up in the kitchen? And then they'll decide. But of course they protest, and they'll argue over who does what, and they'll say, why should I do it? And then I say, well, why should I do it? I you know, we're all in this together, team, and that sort of thing. And then another great parenting tip I'll share with you, which I love, is Allison Schaefer, who's a parenting expert. I read a lot of her books, and she has this great tactic where you phrase things in such a way that they don't really have a choice. So you say, when you clean up the kitchen, then you can go outside and play. So it's not, if they know they have to get that done if they're going outside to play. There's no argument to be had there. So it's up to them whether they want to get outside. So I use little tactics like that. But otherwise, I think it really helps to instill responsibility in them, and the household runs so much smoother. I've got so much free time now talking to you.
That's awesome. And, you know, I'm assuming that you would have to start the kids off young if they're going to have a good work ethic about doing household chores.
Oh, absolutely. As soon as they could spit up, they were cleaning it up. No, I'm just kidding. They weren't they weren't cleaning that early. They weren't cleaning as newborns. But I'd say around 2, as soon as they could, you know, follow me around and help out and see what I was doing around the house, then they would help out as well. And kids love to help. Kids want to be part of something important. And if you make them feel like this is really important to get it done, then they absolutely want to help out and get the job done with you. And we have a saying around here, you make the mess, you clean the mess. So as soon as one of my kids, you know, knocks over a glass of milk, the first thing they do is make their way over to the paper towel and tear some off and clean it up. They don't stare at it stunned, and they know exactly what to do. You make the mess, you clean the mess, and it's pretty easy.
And I have a question, too, about your hubby, Brad, because you said that you guys already make a great team. Was he obviously very proactive about this, too, about the boys, you know, starting off young and having a good work ethic?
Well, he's a great husband. He's a great husband, and he was always very independent. He had his own house when I met him. He managed it quite beautifully. It wasn't, you know, a dump. It was pretty neat and tidy and organized. So he already brought that to the relationship, and then I brought this desire to instill in the kids those same values. So he sees it as very important as well. There's no scene around the house where we're doing all the work as the parents and the kids are just sitting there moving their thumbs doing a video game. Like that is not happening, and that's not how a team works. And there's no way that's going to happen around this household. And it would be really great if more parents got their kids involved, because it really benefits you as a parent. You're less stressed. You've got less to do. Everyone's pitching in. You've got the family harmony. And best of all, when they grow up, you know that they will be capable of doing for themselves.
And, you know, if parents have started late, Casey, how can they sort of turn things around and get their kids to shape up?
You know what? They can't. It's too late. I'm just kidding. I don't even know. Maybe it is too late. I have no idea. And you know, one thing that I said in the blog, which could very well be true, and I'm sure with three kids it's bound to happen with one of them, is someone most likely will end up being a hoarder out of my kids or have some, you know, psychological damage from having to participate in all these household chores, some rebellion. But it's never too late to get kids involved. And kids want to be a part. Every book I read always says the same thing. Kids want to feel important and want to have a role in the family. So if you can find what role suits them best, and kids want to contribute. So, I mean, it's a win-win. It's easy.
And I'm assuming, because, you know, you've started them off so young and now it's just like they don't know any different, right? And I'm assuming that for you and Brad, it's going to be like, I'm knocking on wood for you, but I think it's going to be easier for you as they transition into the, you know, god-awful teens, because they won't know anything different. Because I know when I was a kid, like I grew up on a farm, so there was no ifs, ands, or buts. Like we had chores to do. I had a job by the time I was 9, like physical job, you know, in the summers. And so I didn't know any different. So when I turned, you know, 13, 14, I might have had a bit more moody spells, but I knew damn well like I had stuff to do. And I think that's where a lot of parents experience problems, is if they let their kids get away with stuff when they're, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, they are not going to do it when they're 13, 14, 15.
Oh, exactly. It's like brushing your teeth, right? I can't imagine suddenly telling someone who's never brushed their teeth ever before at the age of 50 that you've got to start brushing your teeth. It's important. It's going to be tough to take that on and remember to do it all the time and it just be part of your daily routine. These are just part of our daily routines. My kids have been dressing themselves independently since they were 2, and that's why they look so bad. If you see them, if you ever bump into them, you know, there was Noah went through an entire phase where he wore his pants backwards because he liked having the rear pockets in the front to store things. So,
wow.
I mean, I've got Christmas photos of them sitting on Santa's lap with their pants on backwards, boots on the wrong feet, and shirts inside out. But you know what? I didn't have to dress them. So that's some time savings right there. And they've got a skill. So you've got to pick your battles.
Nice. And, you know, do you believe that, you know, what you're doing with the boys is really going to prepare them for marriage?
Well, let's face it. No one's ever prepared for marriage. But at least if they hook up with some partner in life, at least I know that she cannot possibly come to me and say, do you know you raised a boy who doesn't even know how to pick up his own clothes? Then I will know she is nuts, because I did my damnedest to make sure that those boys are good marriage material and can live on their own, live as part of a family. I just want them to be contributing members of society that have good, solid work ethic.
Excellent. Casey, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
My pleasure as always.
That's Casey Savage again, Almost Mother of the Year. Make sure to check her out at almostmotherofthyear.blogspot.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show this week as we took a look back at some of our favorite memories from the past year. I am very grateful to all of our guests for being so gracious with their time and expertise. And I'm very excited to let you know that next week we will be back with brand new programming. Before I let you go for this week, though, here is your inspirational quote of the week, this time from Alfred Adler. Trust only movement. Life happens at the level of events, not words. There you go. Have an awesome week. Any comments or questions, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. You and I'll chat soon.